Forging a strong common identity is the basic challenge of a people. For the Palestinians, this has proven to be a complex undertaking. Without the defining structure of a nation-state, Palestinians have had to define themselves within the context of the intertwined histories of their region. It's been a struggle in itself, marked by political suppression and economic exploitation. It's a story with many chapters, perhaps the most dramatic, are yet to be written as the Palestinian people contemplate the prospect of statehood. My guest is Rashid Khalidi, professor of Middle East history and director of the Center for International Studies at the University of Chicago. Rashid, welcome to Dialogue.
Pleasure.
It was a pleasure also, Rashid, reading your book. Let me thank you for that opportunity, the book Palestinian Identity. And right at the outset, Rashid, I discovered something that really fascinated me. First of all, there's a very poignant reference at the start to the anxiety felt by Palestinians as they confront so mundane a task as crossing borders.
Right.
And at the same time, the message of this book is that the Palestinians, against many obstacles, have forged a very strong sense of self-identity. And that seemed to me a paradox in this sense, that perhaps the world, the international community, has a very poor understanding of Palestinians, at the same time that Palestinians have a very strong sense of themselves. Is that essentially the paradox?
I think it is a paradox. I think you're right. And I think that paradoxically, if I may use the word, the very difficulty that Palestinians have at boundaries, borders, checkpoints, has been one of the factors that has reinforced their identity. I mean, they have a sense of identity.
Right.
The powers that be know that they're a cause of trouble, that they are different, that they are unique. Mm-hmm. And paradoxically, again, that very uniqueness that sets them apart has been a source of unending worry for them at these checkpoints, borders, and so on. The number of times that, I mean, I carry an American passport. I was born in New York. There's no indication that I'm Palestinian from anything on my passport. I have an Arab name, but the number of times I've been told to step aside at an airport in this or that country, and are legion. Mm-hmm. And the same kind of stories can be told by so many Palestinians. And I realized as I was planning to write a completely different introduction to this book, mm-hmm. that this actually was where I should start it.
I'm glad you did, because as a non-Palestinian, this made it all extremely personal mm-hmm. to me, and I think brought home the anxiety that must exist when you live in this kind of climate of continual suspicion. And of course, defining themselves in these difficult circumstances has been kind of a leitmotif of the Palestinian experience, I would gather, for some time. I got the sense, as I read the book, Rashid, that it's been, with this most recent example and earlier ones, largely a process of defining themselves in terms of outside forces mm-hmm. and narratives, not just Zionism, which is the one we're most familiar with most recently, but even Arabism mm-hmm. and political forces within the region. I mean, these have been sort of a relationship to the other, the
right.
outside. That
right.
Is that right?
Well, it's almost a commonplace that identity is in some measure defined vis-a-vis an other.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I tried to explore in this book, or one of the things I tried to explore, was the multiplicity of others against whom the Palestinians define
exactly.
themselves. I mean, I tried to suggest that there are all kinds of elements of identity that were mm-hmm. pre-existing. But in terms of an other, we tend to be told that it's in relation to Israel or Zionism that the Palestinians are defined themselves, have to be understood. And what I understood as I did the research for this book was that there's a multiplicity
exactly.
of other others.
This research, in a fascinating way, draws on the experience of your own ancestors and your own family
mm-hmm.
in a way that I found, as I said, quite fascinating. And in terms of these others, I think the subject itself is worthy of a long discussion, but to give it a kind of an emphasis, a lot of the otherness has been extremely antagonistic. For example, mm-hmm. I got the impression that in the British Mandate, it was essentially, the tactic was a negation.
Right, absolutely.
Of Palestinian identity.
Absolutely. One of the ironies of the British Mandate for Palestine was that the Palestinians were never mentioned in the mandate itself. The word Arab, the word Palestinian doesn't exist. There is a national entity described as being in existence in Palestine, and that's mm-hmm. the Jewish people, who are described as having national rights. And much of the mandate document, in fact, devotes itself to laying out how Britain was supposed to relate to those national rights. The Arabs and the Palestinians are neither mentioned in the Balfour Declaration, which was the basis of the mandate, nor in the mandate itself. So here again is another one of those ironies of Palestinian history.
Right. Let me focus on this importance of the land,
mm-hmm.
because one of the major central revelations of the book to me was the importance of the land and the entire Middle East dialogue or narratives, so to speak, and particularly the relationship of the people who work the land, the Fellaheen,
right.
in terms of Palestinian identity. Before I turn to them specifically, Rashid, this question, is the very dispute over Jerusalem, and what I gathered was its essential sacredness to multiple populations, an example of this? I mean, the fact that this land is not just land to possess, it's sacred territory.
Right. I think that there are two things to Jerusalem. One is the one you touched on. It is sacred. It's multiply sacred. Mm-hmm. It's sacred in some senses in different ways and in some senses in the very same way to completely different religious traditions. There's extraordinary irony to the fact that they are now debating the Haram al-Sharif Temple Mount. It's the same place, incidentally. And its sacrality, its multiple sacrality, is in some cases a result of shared beliefs, in some cases the result of completely different beliefs. So one element is that element of sacrality. The other thing that I found about Jerusalem is that it is a place which has completely different resonances for different people. They look at the same thing and they see something completely different. Hmm. Different peoples, some of them having nothing to do, one would think, with Jerusalem. It's easy to see Palestinians and Israelis, but foreign pilgrims who've never been there, people who, in fact, are not even pilgrims, people who talk or think about Jerusalem. We might think about the number of place names in the United States which have biblical origins or are related
exactly.
to Jerusalem. There are actually hundreds and thousands of them. Mm-hmm. And for people for whom the Bible is meaningful, for people for whom the Quran is meaningful, which is to say hundreds of billions of people or tens of billions of people around the world, most of whom have never been anywhere near Jerusalem, this is a city that has extraordinary meaning. So there are all kinds of multiple sacralities. And then, as I try and touch on in the book, there are different archaeological strata.
I was struck by that, yeah. I mean, you can sort of literally layer by layer, level by level, go back and find reinforcement for different versions.
Right, right. Okay. And it's easy to elide or occlude or ignore or obliterate with bulldozers sometimes. Strata.
Yeah.
You can not talk about certain things. You can focus on certain things. Mm-hmm. You can read a great deal or sometimes too much into a given level or what may or may not be found at a given level. And of course, all of this is related to politics
exactly.
because who controls a territory politically controls what is done with the archaeological investigation beneath that territory.
To take that as a focus, Rashid, for an additional moment, when people do that, when they focus on this particular strata as opposed to that and reinforce this particular narrative as opposed to that, is the end result an extremely polemical, oppositional sort of telling of the story that, I mean, becomes a problem in itself, an issue in itself?
Yes, I think that is part of the problem. But I think you have to recognize that there are narratives which have developed a weight, a valence, which is beyond our ability to do anything about.
Yeah.
A biblical narrative
right.
is not something you can say, well, we can ignore the biblical narrative. I mean, there are a lot of, I think, very fine archaeologists and very fine historians who argue that what's in the Bible, as far as, for example, the Solomonic period or the period of King David, is not really very easy to verify historically.
Mm-hmm.
But for anybody who believes in any one of the revealed religions, not just Judaism and Christianity, for that matter, Islam, these are matters of absolute faith and
Absolutely.
Belief. You can't
yeah.
argue with those things. So these are narratives with a weight and a valence that necessarily affects archaeology and everything else. And, you know, I'm very sympathetic to my colleagues in the archaeological and anthropological and ancient historical professions who try and go up against these windmills. But they're very, very, very tough.
And again, I'm fascinated by this. And you're absolutely right. You're not going to compromise on sacrality. I mean, that's and that's a given, and that has to be understood and accepted. But will that make, and I know this is very speculative, Rashid, but does that make the problem of Jerusalem ultimately intractable? Or is there a way of, what do you do in that circumstance?
It may, to the extent to which politicians let this thing get away from them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one can be very blunt about this. The kind of emotional issues raised by Jerusalem, the kind of emotional issues raised by religion, as we know from our own politics in this country, can get completely out of hand.
Yes.
And they certainly have the potential for doing that here, both on the Israeli side and on the Palestinian side, and beyond the Israeli side, to everybody for whom the biblical narrative has resonance and for everybody for whom the Quranic narrative has resonance. It's sometimes argued, well, Jerusalem isn't mentioned in the Quran. Not only is Jerusalem mentioned in the Quran, the fate of the temple, both temples, is mentioned in the Quran.
Right.
So this is a narrative which has resonance for everybody, at least of the three monotheistic faiths. And To the extent to which politicians let this thing get out of control, or even worse, exploit it, throw kerosene on the flames, we are talking about an absolutely intractable issue, potentially.
I want to take us outside of Palestine proper for a moment, then come back to it, and touch upon something that's also a big interest of your scholarship on the region, and that's the fact, to put it concisely, that so much of the Palestinian population exists in the diaspora. In Lebanon, for example, in particular. That's a vast topic again. But and particularly with the prospect of some form of statehood emerging, what's the complication that represents for the ongoing definition of Palestinian identity, achievement of statehood, and the definition of it?
Well, this is a big topic. Very simply, one of the issues is going to be, is Palestine going to be the state of all Palestinians or the state of the people who live within it? Does Yasser Arafat and the PLO, do they represent the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, or all those people who originate in Palestine? For anybody with any knowledge of the region, this will have resonance in terms of Israel. Is Israel a state of the entirety of the Jewish people, or is it a state of the Israeli citizens?
In other words, the people wherever resident, or the people...
Precisely. These are not exact parallels, but there is a little bit of a similarity here. And the Palestinians are wrestling with just that issue right now.
Let me take a moment from our conversation, though, Rashid, to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is Rashid Khalidi, professor of Middle East History and director of the Center for International Studies at the University of Chicago. Rashid, let me come to what, for me at least, this reader was probably the major revelation of the book. In terms of Palestinian identity, I think for an outside audience, certainly this American layman, I've tended perhaps to focus too much on the post-1948 period. The book revealed to me the much earlier origins in the 20th century of this phenomenon. But in addition, and do correct me if I'm wrong, the fact that it was not initially or not so much an elite phenomena as a question of the fellaheen's relationship to the land, the fact that absentee landlords had largely been selling the land out from under them. They had the use of it, if not the ownership. Their resistance to that, their resentment of that, and that is a major element and what Palestinian identity has become.
Well, you've summarized the book very well, actually. If there were something that I would lay even more stress on now, and something I'm actually currently working on, it's something that grows out of that. And I touch on it in the book, and it's the extent to which you were talking about, by the 1930s anyway, a mass movement which involved the Fellaheen in a very direct way in politics, and this in the context of the revolt of 1936, the strike, and then the revolt of 1936 to 1939. So, in fact, that is one of the things that I come up with in this book. The role played by members of the elite and intellectuals and newspaper owners on the one hand, but the resonance of these things in terms of a struggle over the land with the peasants, with the Fellaheen. And then, as I would now add, and as I hope to do more work on, the extent to which that worked itself out in popular politics in the 30s and then again later and up to this day. I mean, we've seen it again a decade ago with the Intifada, starting in 1987. I mean, this is a revolutionary mass movement if ever there was one. You couldn't have told people to go out and get shot down or beaten the way they were. They had to be moved by something as a collective, and that clearly is what happened all across the occupied territories.
It's a story, largely, I thought, of local passions in the sense that, I mean, I kind of visualize it as I read it, that the people had the use of these lands, they found themselves dispossessed from those lands, and then arriving waves of Zionist immigration had different character. It seemed to me that at least at some point the phrase conquest of labor enters the story, and perhaps things get more militant and more oppositional at that phase.
Well, it's true. I mean, the first settlers in what's called the first Aliyah came to what were sort of plantation colonies. That is to say, they were, in a sense, the overseers and the skilled laborers. And the Palestinians, whose land had, in fact, already been alienated, continued to work the land. So whereas they had been sharecroppers or working for Arab landlords, now they were working for Jewish landlords. And it was not until the second Aliyah, which came with new ideas, and which was much more nationalistic and much more explicit in its understanding of what had to be done if this were to become a Jewish country, that you had this process of conquest of labor, which in effect meant Jews doing the work rather than Arabs. And that initiated a struggle that really went on right up until 1948 for both demographic control and control of land, in which this issue of labor and who would till the land and who would control the land was absolutely central. I might add that since 1948 until today, anybody who knows anything about the dispute will continue to tell you that issues of demography and issues of control of land are still central in the eyes of both peoples.
That bears a lot of emphasis. I think that is exactly right and borne out in this story. And why is this story so unknown? I mean, the story of the fellaheen, as I said, was not the radio elevation that I found. I don't think many others have heard the story.
Well, there are two sets of reasons. In terms of why the story of the fellaheen was not known, this is an issue in Middle East history and to some extent history everywhere, which is that history is told from the top down, it's told in terms of the elites, it's told in terms of the records that are most accessible to us, and it's told in terms of the stories that appear on the surface to be the most interesting. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the newspaper editor, the deputy, the political figure, the king, the president, whatever, the pharaoh is always the subject of the easiest research. You know, look at the pyramid and you look at the person who in whose name it was built. You don't look at the people who built it. Similarly, in modern Palestinian history, there's been a tendency to focus on the easy records, which are the records produced by the literate elite. So that's one level on which there was a problem. A second level, more peculiar to the Palestinian case, is that telling the Palestinian story was seen by many people as negating the Israeli story. If you told Palestine, it meant you were untelling Israel.
These are the polemical narratives.
Exactly, which I talk about here. Mm-hmm. And this has always been a problem in this country. I mean, I grew up in the United States at a time when, in New York City, at a time when you really couldn't say Palestine. It was seen, the very word, the very term, was seen as a negation of what had just immediately preceding that time that I was thinking of, the 50s, been created, which is to say Israel. And that is part of the problem as well. If you talk about the Palestinians as a people with a background, with a history, with a tradition, you seem to be saying this is the legitimate owner, this is the legitimate rightful inhabitant, and everybody else, is, i.e. Israel, is a usurper. And that's a very difficult issue.
Absolutely.
I think it's occluded a lot of discussion. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are many people who go berserk when this subject is mm-hmm. discussed. Otherwise, normal, rational, sane, mm-hmm. moderate people who become unhinged if pushed on this issue.
You give us a real sense of the challenge of dialogue in the region. I think that's an absolutely well-taken point. Another well-taken point from the book, it struck me, Rashid, is there is, again to use the word, a point in the perhaps 20s or 30s, I'm not quite remember quite exactly when, but when the press and the media becomes mm-hmm. a factor here and essentially begins to retell this story.
Right.
And perhaps to give impulse to the sense of it as a push for self-government, is that right?
Right. I actually trace it back even before that, mm-hmm. right after the 1908 revolution in the mm-hmm. Ottoman Empire.
The press is active then?
Precisely. When the press is sort of liberated from the controls of the Ottoman government, and you begin to have people, as you say, mm-hmm. Retelling the story. Mm-hmm. And so you have newspapers like Filastin, which means Palestine, or Al Karmel, which is Carmel, Mount Carmel. And others, Al-Quds, Jerusalem, which in effect are reframing the issue. It's not only in terms of Ottoman or Arab identity, though those are there.
Right.
In fact, those are very much more important in some respects than others. Or religion, which is also there and very important. But it is increasingly a sense of relationship to place. Now, that becomes even more intense. This is probably what you're thinking of in the 20s and the 30s.
Yeah, right. And so what's the further effect of that? The fact that now you have the media, which we associate, I suppose, at obvious levels with the intelligentsia mm-hmm. and the urban elites and so forth. Does it begin to forge a unified consciousness, or what does it do in that sense?
Well, the point, it's very hard to determine. I've had arguments with some of my colleagues in the historical Middle East history field about this. It's hard to determine what the effect of the press is in a mm-hmm. society which is largely illiterate. Mm-hmm. And I've done some research and I've collected accounts, and it is clear that the impact of these newspapers goes beyond the number of people who actually might have purchased them mm-hmm. or who actually might have been able to read them, because these things were read out loud in mm-hmm. villages mm-hmm. by the mukhtar, in coffee shops, mm-hmm. by whoever could read, in the family. The father would come home. I mean, my aunt told me this story about her dad coming home. This must have been before the turn of the century in Beirut. And reading the newspaper, and the whole family, he had, I don't know, 11 children, would sit there, as well as God knows how many hangers-on, sit there listening. Now, 20 of the 30 people in the room, or 10 or 15 or whatever, may have been illiterate, but they were being exposed to the press. Hmm. And we know this is the case. I mean, to this day, people read newspapers in coffee shops in the Middle East.
That's right.
And people used to read them out loud. It's a little noisy in Beirut or in Ramallah to do that today. Mm-hmm. But in those days, that's what people did, or at least this is what people tell me. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of evidence that that's the case. So it's very difficult to determine what the extent of influence of these papers are. It's far beyond the circulation figures, but how does one quantify it? How does one assess it? I think, though, that it must have been great.
Maybe one way, and I think you're right about the elusiveness of getting a hold on this in a kind of a... ultimate way, but I was fascinated. I think you carefully studied 22 papers, 10 very closely, and then 10 sort of monitoring. So how extensive a phenomena was the major print media in Palestine at the time? I mean, does that, I'm trying to get a sense of what that number of papers means. Is that...
Well, I mean, the study that I did covered a period when the press probably wasn't as important as it came to be. That was the pre-World War I period. It was important, but not as important as it came to be. There was a very large number of papers in Palestine. And one of the striking thing is the plethora of different opinions that those newspapers represented and the extent of their distribution. I looked at several libraries in the Jerusalem area, the Cheldi Library, a library that my grandfather founded, the Buderi, the Library of the Al-Aqsa, and a couple of other private collections. And the extraordinary thing was the number of papers, not just from Palestine, but from other parts of the Arab world, from Cairo and Beirut and Damascus in particular, which I found in these libraries. People were clearly reading right across the spectrum from places quite far removed from Palestine, as well as papers from all over Palestine. And every time I've gotten a bunch of, when I'm working in the library, I see stuff that's coming in the Cheldi Library in Jerusalem. Each bunch of papers from somebody include, you know, private papers and books and so forth, includes newspapers from all over the place. It's really quite remarkable. So I think it would take take more research to determine the exact answer to your question, but I think that the impact of the press is hard to overestimate.
Exactly, and I hope that research gets done, because the kind of intellectual fervor that your grandfather must have been part of, I mean, getting these ideas and contributing to them, of course, in the form of the papers is...
It was fun to find articles that he had written, and then I found out that he was writing for a newspaper which my wife's grandfather founded, and I found that they were good friends, and so the newspaper articles he was writing and his friends... a newspaper were the result of conversations between them. I mean, I just found that out by chance. But
that's the beauty of history, though. It's a human story.
Yeah.
And written within one family in this instance. That's fascinating. Rashid, this almost reads like a novel, because there's a point at which the phenomenon of Palestinian identity sort of, well, use the word, disappears or goes off the map or sort of is not as prominent. I think post-1948 might be a demarcation where there's at least a point where it's not so powerful a phenomenon. It may even, I won't use the word vanish, but at least become less notable than it had been. Why is that? And more importantly, what brings it us back from that?
Well, I talk about these as the lost years after 1948. I got a letter recently from someone whose father was, in fact, involved in an attempt to resuscitate Palestinian identity in the immediate post-1948 period. And she argued, I think correctly, that in fact it never disappeared. There were people always trying to fight to bring it forward. But in fact, it appeared to have disappeared. And the reasons I go into it a little bit in the book, and I think there's more that can be done on this. Palestinian society was shattered by the 1948 war. Most Palestinians became refugees, a majority of the 1,400,000 Palestinians became refugees. Most of the territory of Palestine, 77% of the country, became Israel. And so for a variety of reasons having to do with the after effects of that and having to do with the shattering of the dominant political elite, which had led the Palestinians up to that point, it took a while before a new leadership could emerge, before a new voice for the Palestinians could be found. So I talk about these as the lost years. What brought them back was efforts of their own, really. And I go into this only in a cursory form in this book. But it's an interesting story, how in the 50s and 60s, the Palestinians, in a sense, revived their own national identity.
I've used the phrase before, but I really always mean it, especially in this time. Do correct me if I'm wrong on this, because I found one of the, in this particular chapter, one of the points that I thought I understood really, really, really gripping. It's kind of an ironic point, and that, to put it in a capsule, the 1948 period and just after did represent a series of setbacks.
Right.
Economic and military and political.
Absolutely. For the Palestinians.
And for the Palestinians, exactly. But it, and the irony is here, there was those very setbacks that made people feel, in a sense, we're all in it together, that
Absolutely.
Might have been the basis for the restoration of the
Absolutely.
Identity. I mean, I'm sure your friend is right, it never disappeared, but to bring it fully to the fore again, the unifying factor were the setbacks.
What I say in the book, no, you are right. What I say in the book is that if the Palestinians ever had any doubt that they formed a collective, the impact of 1948 erased that. They were branded in their own minds. They were traumatized collectively by a set of experiences that transcended anything that they'd gone through in the 20s and the 30s, and which to this day is sort of the bedrock of modern Palestinian identity. When you talk to somebody and ask them, where are you from, a Palestinian, they don't say, I'm from, you know, I live in Hyde Park in Chicago, or I live in wherever. they talk about the town or village or city from which their family originally came before 1948. In some cases, they still live there. But in most cases, they do not.
Right.
So you have people who say, oh, I'm from Jaffa. Well, I mean, their grandfather was from Jaffa. The point is that that is the where the timeline starts,
yeah.
1948.
Yeah. Well, Rashid, as I expected, it's a fascinating conversation because it's a fascinating book. And I think lay people such as myself can gain as much from this as scholars because
well,
it is
you.
Largely an unknown story, but it's very creatively revealed here. So to conclude, Rashid, as I've given you really big questions in a short space of time, I'll give you an even bigger one in an even shorter space of time. But what's next? I mean, with Palestinian statehood, you don't have a crystal ball about what that's going to look like, but I mean, what are the major challenges that are going to have to be taken into account in the work in progress of Palestinian identity?
My favorite answer to this kind of question is that as a historian, our job description does not include predicting
the
future.
I knew you were going to say that, but I'm not going to let you off with
so
that.
I don't know. I mean, I don't think that anything is inevitable. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that that's the way history works. It could well be that this will be a people with a powerful sense of identity and strong national aspirations, and that those aspirations will continue to be frustrated indefinitely. Mm. It could be that they will have a very unsatisfactory fulfillment of their national aspirations, mm-hmm. that they will have a half state, a truncated state, a crippled state, a handicapped state, a state which is totally dependent under external control. That's the situation now of the Palestinian Authority. And it could be that they will find some kind of fulfillment. Mm-hmm. I think any one of those three options is a distinct possibility. I could easily chart out in the present and the past routes for any one of those three.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, for everybody concerned, I hope the third because it's the only one, some fulfillment, because
right.
I think it's the only one that brings a prospect to a resolution of this conflict, mm-hmm. which in some measure has to do with what happened, the frustration of Palestinian aspirations and what happened to the Palestinians as a result. That's not the only story,
mm-hmm.
but that's a big part of the story. And if something is not doesn't happen which addresses that, I think it'd be very difficult to foresee
yeah.
a peaceful and stable Middle East.
I hate to use a cliche, but it does strike me the crossroads is an apt metaphor for mm-hmm. the kind of decision. Rashid Khalidi, thank you so much for being with us on Dialogue. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And
it's a pleasure to talk to you again, George. Thanks.
Thank you. You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Rashid Khalidi, professor of Middle East History and director of the Center for International Studies at the University of Chicago. I'm George Liston-Cie, producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Reed, our technical director is John Tyler, and our production assistant is Andrea Bertone. Dialogue is presented by PRI Public Radio International and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
To order a Dialogue program or for more information, contact us at 202-691-4146. You can also listen to Dialogue on the web at wilsoncenter.org/dialogue. Email us on America Online at radiodial@aol.com.